Good morning, everyone. My name is Mark Pesci. I want to thank you very much for having me here for two reasons. First off, I have an honorary associate appointment here, which I got last February, and for which since then I have done absolutely nothing. So you're helping me work off the burden that I feel to be associated with this fine institution. Second reason is that you are my test case. You can think of me as a bit of a stand-up comic, although I don't think it's going to be very funny. But I've got to try my material before I take it on the road, and I'm taking this material on the road later this year to Budapest and to Costa Rica for different conferences. So what I want to do is share with you what I've been thinking about lately, and I want to hear back from you whether you think it's true, whether you think it's bullshit, whatever. Feel free, put your hand up if you hit something that you just don't agree with and you want to engage me on it. And the first thing I want to point out, which I guess Kathy has already mentioned to you, most of you are between, I guess, 18 and 20 years old. So you're between 5 and 7 years old when the web, well, not quite was invented, but when it started becoming popular, I think 1994 is a sort of benchmark there. And I was 31 when that happened. So my perspective today is going to be about the perspective of the changes that have happened and what those changes imply for the way things are now and the way things might be in the future. And the interesting thing is that in the whole scheme of a lifetime, these transformations are going to seem huge. They're going to seem the equivalent of electrification, which came to Australia, say, 120 years ago. The invention of the internal combustion engine, again, about 120 years ago. Or the invention of radio just over 100 years ago. But these transformations are that broad, that profound, and it's very hard to imagine a before time. And I'm not really going to talk about the before time. I'm not going to talk about the olden days. What I am going to talk about is that the revolution that's taking place is only growing stronger, and it's only accelerating. So the title of the lecture today is Pax Populi. Part one, a screaming comes across the net. Oh. Here's a scene you might be familiar with. It's 11 p.m. in the university library, and you're sitting there doing your studying. And at 11 p.m., campus security walks through the library to check the student IDs to make sure that only the students with IDs are sitting in the library at that hour, because you don't want the wrong kind of people in there. And you've forgotten yours. And your flat is on the other side of campus, and it's going to be an hour lost to studying if you have to go back, get your ID, and come back to the library. You won't get there till practically midnight, and you've had a bad day, and you're a little bit upset. And so when campus security hassles you for the ID that you don't have, you get a little nasty. And they haven't had a great day either, and so they're not having any either. And it gets more heated. Now, this really happened. And of course, it happened in the United States where, being an American, I can tell you we love weapons. And of course, it happened in Los Angeles, and I can tell you that cops love weapons in Los Angeles. In fact, they're probably weapon crazy. And even though these aren't actually really police, they're campus police, and you can probably know from your own personal experience that the relationship, the amount of power that a policeman has is inversely proportional to how much they tend to lord it over you. And these campus police don't actually have guns, but the university has decided to issue them with that wonderful, non-invasive, non-destructive weapon, the taser. You all know what a taser is, right? It generates a 50,000 volt charge between two points. You put it up to someone, and they get very upset. So these cops, arguing with this student, decide that they're going to teach him a lesson. And it might sound something like this.
Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Don't touch me! You are the best.
And they might say to you six or seven or eight times because you're not moving, because they've tasered you six or seven or eight times. But this is November of 2006. And because this is a library, there are witnesses. And because this is November of 2006, the witnesses are all college students, and all of the college students have mobile phones. And plenty of those mobile phones have video cameras built into them. Now, how many of you do not own a mobile phone? I'm assuming that's your criminal past, but we won't worry about it. But that's about the right proportion. How many of you have mobile phones with video cameras built into them? All right, so that's about 60-70% of you. So for you folks, it's the rule rather than the exception. 2 years ago when I got my first phone with a video camera, and it was pretty much the exception rather than the rule during emerging technology. And so there wasn't just one camera that was present at this event in the library in November of 2006. There were several. And because this is 2006, because the net's there, and it's always there, and if you're a student at UCLA, you're always quite used to using the net, what do? You take the video that you captured on your camera, and you upload it to YouTube. And you tell your friends about it, and you hit the share button and tell them, and then they tell their friends about it, and they hit the share button and tell them. And they tell a few friends, and they tell a few friends. And before you know it, a million people have watched a little video that you made on your camera phone that you uploaded to the net. And before you know it, the LA Times is asking a lot of questions. And this video clip, because it's video, and because it features a young man screaming quite clearly in pain repeatedly, makes a really good lead on the nightly news in Los Angeles, and then on the nightly news across North America, and then on SBS World News Australia, which is where I first saw it. So all of a sudden, something that happened in a library at UCLA becomes a worldwide media event. And all of a sudden, if you're one of the cops who did the tasering, you're in an awful lot of trouble. You never even saw this coming. You never even thought about the fact that if you're doing something, well, you know, a few years ago, maybe someone might have had a camera, camcorder at an event like this, and what would you do? You'd take the tape away from them. No tape, no event, it's your word against theirs, everything goes on as it did before. But now, what do we have? Well, now we have a room full of kids who watch you tasering someone, and every one of those kids is potentially a videographer who's capturing the event and then sharing that event online. So you always have to ask yourself now, who's watching and why are they watching? Now, as of about 4 months ago, 2 billion people on planet Earth have mobile phones. All right? It took about 10 years to get to the first billion. It took about 2 years to get to the second billion. They think it's going to take about 18 months to get to the third billion. That's half of everyone on planet Earth is going to have a mobile phone. And somewhere between 100 to 150 million of those mobile phones have cameras inside of them, have video cameras inside of them. All right? And so those cameras are going everywhere now, and they're potentially seeing everything now. So potentially there's no event now that happens anywhere that isn't within shot of someone with a camera. You remember when the London subway got bombed 2 years ago, 7/7? The first pictures of that event showed up on Flickr, not on the BBC. All right? Because someone had a camera phone They snap a shot when they were walking out of the subway. They shot some video when they were walking out of the subway. They hit a few buttons and uploaded it to Flickr. So already the news organizations are behind the curve on this because, in fact, the fact that everyone is fully enabled with their own cameras and their own video cameras are able to now outpace the media in their spread of information. And it's interesting that this effect has nothing to do with the people who actually design these cameras. So Nokia or Samsung or Motorola or Sony Ericsson, whoever it was, when they designed your phone, they thought, oh, it would be great, you know, you'll be able to make some video and share it with your friends or, you know, whatever it might be, and put it in because it's a nice feature to have in a phone. But it's not world-shaking, it's just a nice feature to have in a phone. And then, that's true over there, but then when you have this other thing floating around, YouTube, which was designed for a way to people to share little clips of things maybe they'd made, or originally probably to share things they taped off the telly, but that's gotten YouTube into a bit of trouble lately. YouTube was this sort of cloud of thing over here where people are sharing clips that might have come off the telly or something they made themselves. And then you have people with all these camera phones over here. And they're both kind of good on their own. But when they smash into each other, it's like a nuclear explosion. All right? Because it's not just the fact that the phone is everywhere. And it's not just the fact that YouTube can get something everywhere. It's when you put them together that now you have a phone that can reach everyone on the planet. All right, not by dialing a number, but by shooting some video and putting it up on YouTube and then letting the crowd do what it may. And let me talk for a second about how crowds work like that. Because this is a phenomenon that you participate in every day, but let me talk about the mechanics of it. You're confronted with all of this media. You live in specific, in a very media-rich environment, in the way that I, growing up with four channels of television, not very different from Australia still, but when I grew up, four channels of television, basically we got three networks plus PBS. Did not live in a particularly media-rich environment. Most of my childhood was lived before the VCR. DVDs didn't come out until I was in my 30s, all sorts of things like that. You guys have media on your phones, you have media on your computers, and you're very used to this idea that media is this sort of ephemeral object that you can copy and trade wherever you like. Well, why do you do it? How do you do it? Well, each of you sit in a network with all of your friends, and you know what your friends' tastes are. Some friends have very different tastes than other friends. But when you look at something and it makes you laugh, or you go, that's cool, or you go, that's gross, you immediately know who's going to enjoy that. And the next thing you do is forward it on to them. So you do three things. You find things, because we're in this media-rich environment, we're constantly finding stuff. You filter based on what the tastes and sensitivities of your friends are, and then you forward. Find, filter, forward, the three F's. That's the basic dynamic for how all this media is getting out everywhere now. All right? And that's as true for a clip on YouTube as it is for a joke that you might get in an email or a picture you found in Flickr or whatever it might be. It's the basic operating principle that makes this whole thing run. Okay. Any questions so far? All right, so part two, notes for a scandal. So I sort of sit in an in-between area. Right now I'm an American citizen and I'm well on my way to becoming an Australian citizen. I'm just sort of waiting out the clock on my permanent residence until I can become a citizen. Being someone who lives in both lands, in some sense, I keep my eye on what's going on in America. I keep my eye on what's going on in Australia. And of course, being an American, having kept my eye on American politics for the last 6 years, let's say, it's been, I guess you could call it, a profoundly depressing experience. Because my government, in case you didn't know, is batshit crazy. All right? And the problem there is that it's very, very hard to restrain a government. The government is a very powerful, very monolithic organization, and when it takes it in its collective mind to do something, it's going to do it and it's going to plow over any opposition. Right now, most of the country wants the Iraq War to end, but the government is set against it, and so you've got this sort of friction that's building up between the institutions of governance and the government itself as being sort of two separate things, sort of fighting out how they're going to bring this thing to an end. So the government is very powerful, and so it can ignore you if you have issues with it. It can suppress you if you have issues with it. It can ridicule you. It can fire out enough PR to make your point of view look ridiculous. But what they do, if they disagree with you, is they'll try to disempower you. That's one of the basic things that all governments do, whether they're in Australia or in America or South Africa, it doesn't really matter. And that's the way things have been going pretty much unopposed in America until quite recently. Lately, though, things have been changing in a very unexpected way. Now, you all know what blogs are. Yes, how many of you actually write a blog or post to blogs? It's about 15-20% of you. But you all know what a blog is? Yes? All right. So there are a lot of blogs out there, 60 million, 100 billion, who knows how many there are. The blogs that last the longest are the blogs that have a reason behind them, that have a philosophy. This is a blog about whatever, all right? But it's about this, and we're going to stick to the subject. And there's another place for you to go if you don't want to stick to the subject, but here we talk about this thing. And whether that's one person is pronouncing from on high this thing, or whether it's a whole bunch of people who have grouped together to talk about this thing, those blogs tend to be the most successful because they just reinforce their themes. And if you don't have a theme, things can get sort of very vaporous. So people can blog about themselves, that's a theme. People can blog about what they do, that's another theme. One of the things that I think is most important are people who are blogging about politics right now. And again, these blogs spread by the same rule of finding, filtering, forwarding. If I find a blog that I think is interesting and I know immediately who else is going to find it interesting, I send it off to them. So that's how blogs get readers. And the blogs that have been very consistent about what they're good at and have gotten better at it because they've been practicing being good at have acquired fairly large audiences. And now in America, there's a wealth of political blogs. So the most important of the political blogs in the United States is called Daily Cause. It was founded in 2002 by an ex-Marine, Marcos Matsoulis, who decided that things had gone on long enough and that there needed to be some voices for progressive politics in the country. He knew that the Iraq War was coming and he wanted to see what he could do about mobilizing people to fight against the war, to work toward electing political candidates who would be in line with those views and so on and so forth. And it started off, you know, normally it wasn't particularly big at the beginning, but it stuck to its guns and it grew and it grew and it grew. And now around 2 million people a day, mostly in America, are reading Daily Cause. And anyone can come in and read it, plus you can actually come in, make an account on here, and then write your own blog within Daily Cause. And if they like it, it'll go up here on the front page somewhere, and they'll say this is a blog worth reading. Now, if you remember, a couple of weeks ago, John Howard made a bunch of comments about Barack Obama, which got him into Dutch in America and got him into Dutch over here. And so when that happened, I actually made a couple of postings on my own area in Daily Comms explaining Australia for Americans because, trust me, they think of Steve Irwin and kangaroos. Y'all know this, right? But Australia does not loom large in American consciousness. And so when the Prime Minister of Australia, who they've never heard of before, starts trashing a political candidate, all of a sudden a lot of people are asking, Australia? Wait a minute, what's going on there? So I knew that it was the right time to actually write a post, actually two posts about Australia, how the government works in Australia, what the political parties are in Australia, and put them up there, and I actually got a lot of feedback from people who were interested in those subjects. So this is a community that's organized around political commentary, political subjects. Now, during, let's see if I can find it. You may or may not know that we had that. There we are. Okay.
My friends, we're going to run this campaign on positive, constructive ideas. And it's important that we motivate and inspire people for something. This fellow here over here with the yellow shirt, Makaka, or whatever his name is, he's with my opponent. He's following us around everywhere. And it's just great. We're going to places all over Virginia. And he's having it on film, and it's great to have you here. You show it to your opponent because he's never been there, probably will never come. So
that's George Allen. George Allen is the former senator from Virginia. What you just saw there was him losing the Senate race. All right? It is common political practice in the United States now, and probably should be in Australia, though who knows what will happen, for the opposition campaign to send someone out to photograph the opposition candidate at all stops where they're making public talks. All right? So they can analyze what they're saying, see if they can use it in an ad, see if they can expose something. And the fellow who's following George Allen around, although, and this is in Virginia, so sort of mildly conservative southern state in the United States, was born and raised in Virginia, but happens to be of Indian parentage. So he's not, shall we say, lily white. He's not Anglo-Celtic. I think maybe that's probably the safest way to put it. And George Allen, yes. No. I would have said indigenous American then to differentiate. No, I mean subcontinental Indian. George Allen takes, when he was in college, took place with Confederate Reconstruction Societies and denied he had any Jewish ancestry, although, yes, it turns out his mother is Jewish, but he actually denied it during the public debate. So obviously he's got some issues around race that are going on here. And they got him on camera saying the word macaca, which is, and people looked up the etymology of it, yeah, it's sort of a polite way of using the N-word. And this went on to the tape, and the tape went up on YouTube. And you see, this is, it's up many, many different times on YouTube, and just this one copy has 169,000 views. And trust me, millions and millions of people saw this. And George Allen, Republican senatorial re-election campaign imploded. All right? Because this clip made it to the political blog, and then it just spread out from there. So again, you have something similar to what happened in the UCLA library, only this is happening on a political stage. All right, and that happened primarily through the fact that the video made it up to Daily Kos. Daily Kos was tracking this election very closely because they were strongly supporting the other candidate, Jim Webb, who's now the senator, strongly anti-war senator from Virginia. Now, that's interesting as far as it goes. Again, it's the same thing over again. But there's other ways than it's being used. So, in 2001, Josh Marshall, who was a journalist, decided he was going to found a political blog called The Talking Points Memo. Because politicians, when they're trying to get their message across, constantly refer back to what are called the talking points. And this is designed to be able to see through those talking points. And he had some moderate success through the early 2000s. They actually do investigative journalism. There's a small staff of people, and they actually do some investigative journalism. They post the results of that investigative journalism on the site. And what we started to see now with Talking Points Memo is something actually entirely different than what I just showed you. Turns out that around the beginning of the year, December, January, an article appeared in a newspaper, I believe, in Pennsylvania, about the fact that the U.S. attorney for one of the districts in Pennsylvania, the United States has 93 U.S. attorneys. So these are federal prosecutors. They work for the attorney general, and they file federal lawsuits, criminal lawsuits against people. So that might be drug trafficking. It might be immigration violations. It might be campaign fraud. It's a wide range of things, but they're all federal clients. And these, there's only 93 of them for all the United States. They're very, very powerful, and they're appointed by the president. So one of them got fired back in November, and Josh was reading about it and just sort of made a note of it on his blog. Oh, this is interesting, this federal prosecutor just got fired. And then he got an email from someone who was in Washington going, you know what, here's this article from this newspaper in Washington, one of these prosecutors just got fired. And then from someone in San Diego, oh, this is interesting, this prosecutor just got fired. And then from someone in New Mexico, oh, this is interesting, and then from someone in Arkansas. And all of a sudden, what was just sort of one random event happening way over here started to gather into a much larger picture. But the government had made no statement about the fact that we're firing 8 prosecutors. They'd simply sort of let the news out very slowly over a couple of weeks through a couple of different outlets. And unless these people had all sort of been sensitive to this fact because this blog was sort of organizing that activity, it just would have basically gone unnoticed. But by the beginning of January, it starts to become clear that there weren't just one prosecutor that was fired. there were 8 prosecutors being fired, and some of these prosecutors were actually engaged in corruption probes against Republicans, the party in power. So it starts looking curiouser and curiouser and curiouser, and so they actually start to do more investigative work, and it looks even more curiouser. And now more people are sort of both reading this blog and passing it around to other people. Isn't this getting curious? And of course, there's an ecology of political blogs in the United States where if something's really interesting on one blog, it gets cross-posted to another blog and so on and so forth. So you can start off with maybe the 200,000 or 300,000 people who read Talking Points memo every day learning about something. And then if it's really important enough, that might be 4 or 5 million people who read all of the major political blogs in America who might be aware of something. And that might happen for a couple of days' time. And by the time that happens, by the time enough questions have been raised by it, all of a sudden, the New York Times and the Washington Post start to get interested. Wait, there's smoke here. Maybe there's fire. So, once that happened, once the mainstream media got into the action, things sped up enormously quickly because all of a sudden, they started doing investigating, and they started to find out, well, why did these people get fired? Oh, well, because it was for poor performance. Well, they then looked at the letters. And first off, if you fire someone for political reasons and then say it was for poor performance, you shot yourself in the foot, because the first thing that these people are going to say is, wait, let me show you the letter I got during my last review, all right, which says that I was one of the best prosecutors in the nation. So things aren't adding up. So the more things don't add up, the more people start digging, and the more information starts flowing through Talking Points memo, which now becomes a reference point for the mainstream media who are trying to track the case and do the investigation. All right? So it's being used not just by the community, but by the mainstream media. And so it becomes a focal point for all this different activity. So eventually, the Congress gets involved, and the Congress starts to investigate this whole sorry mess. And the Congress now starts asking for all sorts of documentation about how these decisions got made. And so the Department of Justice, which is doing its best to sort of not feed into this, is doing what they call document dumps. So Friday last and this past Friday at 11 p.m., they dump, I think in the first case, 3,000 pages onto the investigating division of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I don't know how many it was this past weekend. Here you go. Have some fun. At 11 p.m. on Friday night, talk about ruining someone's weekend. All right, because if you're a reporter, this means you're going to spend the entire weekend going through these 3,000 pages. And if you're a congressional investigator, the weekend's also been blown. Thanks a lot. So they do these document dumps at this time because this is the time when people are least likely to spend their time going through it. Well, document dumps, as soon as they came out from the Department of Justice, the Senate Judiciary Committee put them on their website. And Josh Marshall set up a special area on Talking Points memo, and he invited the 300,000 people who are on the Talking Points memo regularly. We have this special area set up. Take a look at some of the documents and share your notes with everyone else. Now, there's a Chinese proverb, many hands make light work. All right? And so when you have several thousand people sharing the workload on going through these documents, they did in 36 hours what probably would have taken an investigation crew a week or two and found all of these discrepancies, which then, of course, then flowed up into the media, which flowed up into the investigating committees, which caused another round of documents. And this is where we are right now. And the way it's looking right now is that this tiny little blog, because of its persistent effort and its ability to harness the collective intelligence of a community of people who are organized around this idea that they're going to be watchdogs over the government, will probably topple the Attorney General, the top law enforcement official of the United States. Now, this is still happening right now, but it's getting worse and it's getting worse. And Bush is sticking up for his Attorney General because his Attorney General knows where all of the bodies are buried. And that probably did a lot of the burying. But it's getting worse and worse. And so what everyone recognized in the mainstream media and also in the blogs as well, is that Talking Points memo was the focal point. It was the way that people were able to organize their activity as a community to make this happen. the interesting thing about this is now you all probably use Wikipedia quite a bit, yeah? No? You don't use Wikipedia at all? You've never touched it, right? You don't know what it is? Yeah, okay, I didn't think so. Alright. So Wikipedia has at its core this idea of collective intelligence, that if all of you contribute something that you happen to know about something, well, then when we get that all together, it adds up to something that's greater than the sum of the parts. And the same thing is going on here now with Talking Points Memo. What we're seeing is it's a new kind of government oversight, where before you might have had something like a consumer, ACCC, or you might have had a non-governmental organization like Common Cause, but now we actually see groups of people who are just simply connected through a blog being able to, in fact, articulate a very strong oversight objective on government simply by sharing the workload, by actually pooling the information that they're gathering, because they're all spread across the country and they all see a little part of the picture, but they know that if they share that part of the picture and pool that data together, they'll actually get a much better picture, and from that they'll actually be able to make some decisive action which might be able to correct a problem. And that's turned out to be powerful enough that it is at the moment taking on and defeating the most powerful government in the world. Okay, part three. The shape of things to come. Now I remember this is back in 1994. I attended the very first conference on the World Wide Web, which was held in Geneva, which is where the web was invented. And at that point, a few thousand people were using the web regularly. And there was a lot of promise at that conference. That was, of all the conferences I've been to, and I've been to a lot of conferences over the years, that was without doubt the most exciting conference I'd ever been to, because everyone was filled with excitement. Everyone could tell that this was going to be the best thing since sliced bread, that it was just going to be joyous, that it was going to be peace and love and understanding, man, and that crazy hippie anarchist shit. We just felt it. And these are all scientists, all right? These are all very sort of high-level, or I should say high-powered PhD-level scientists, and they were all completely flipped out by the potential that was there. And everyone was convinced that it was going to transform everything about everything, and it so did not, at least not right away. In fact, the first thing that happened in the first era, from 1995 to 2000, those first 5 years, were a gold rush. All right. You may or may not be too young to remember this, but essentially, at this point in time, it was very easy to get money to start a company, to do something on the net, whether it was delivering pet food online, or whether it was eBay, or whether it was, there's so many things that went on there that in retrospect seemed incredibly, unbelievably silly. And the idea was to borrow a bunch of money, build a company with it, get a lot of people looking at your site, and then either take the company public through an initial public offering on the stock market, or to sell the company to a bigger company. And so, for instance, Yahoo bought a lot of those companies, as Google does today. But gold rushes have a very particular shape. They have a boom, and then they have a bust. All right? Happened in America in 1849, happened in Australia in 1854, happened in the Yukon in 1901, it happens again and again and again. There's a boom, there's a rush, there's a bust. And that's exactly what happened in 2000. So for 5 years, everyone just thought, my God, this is going to transform everything about business. They poured all this money into it, and then the money evaporated over a period of, I don't know, 6 months. Billions, I mean, actually trillions of dollars were lost, sent economies into a recession. And so after 5 years, people were starting to talk about the death of the web, which I think in retrospect seems very, very funny. Because the thing that we actually learned out of all of this was that the web is not about money. That's an afterthought. That's not what this show is about. It's nice work if you can get it, but it's not the main act. Even though in the early days, people thought, wow, there's gold in them barrels, and they want to have to dig it up. But that was not really the important thing, and that was not the thing that actually changed everything. And what I saw, and I thought it was fairly horrifying, not because getting rich is bad, because it's not, but because when you focus on that as your end, then your means become very, very confused. what I saw was this transition from a room full of scientists going, we're going to change the world, man, to a bunch of MBAs going, we're going to rule the world, man. All right. And the thing is that the net doesn't work like that. The net isn't about domination. And I think I've probably been able to illustrate this with my previous examples to indicate that the more you try to dominate something, the more the net tends to undermine that. All right. The net presents too many openings. China is a really good example. They have the Great Firewall of China, which prevents anything untoward from getting in or getting out. How effective do you really think the Great Firewall of China is? All right, it's not. The Great Firewall of China is backed with a threat of force, that if you violate it, you could get shot. All right, that's the thing that keeps the firewall up. It's not the fact you can't get data from somewhere. All right, it's a legal threat. But networks themselves are designed to be porous. They're designed to copy, and it's very hard to build a network if someone can't find a way around. It's very hard to put information out there that other people can't get and copy. For goodness sakes, file sharing. And so the net's not about dominating or building. Not in any sense that you can actually see. But we didn't know this back in 1995. We didn't know that the empires were built on sand. We had no idea about this. We were able to feel the shape of things to come, but we weren't able to actually see where we would be a couple of years down the line. Now, why is this? All right, it's a very important point. It's the main point I want to make today. All right? For all that we use the net, the thing that we never think about, for all that we use the net is using us. All right? It's a two-way street. Every time you have an interaction with something online, you might leave a little of yourself there, but guess what? It needs a little of itself in you. All right? Take a look around your head and think about all the things that you know because you learned about them online. That's the net in you. It's a two-way street. So every time you use the net, you change the way you behave. And it changes the way you behave, and you change the way it behaves. It's all of a piece. You can't pull these pieces apart. And back in 1995, we didn't really understand any of this because we hadn't really lived through any of it yet. Now, in 2007, it's becoming a little bit clearer how things work. And the third thing that's becoming clear is the net is no more passive than we are. And, you know, you can talk about the net. The net's not this abstract thing. It's not a set of cables. It's not a set of computers. That's not what I mean. It's the billion other people who are online. All right, but you call it the net because there's no way for us to sort of cram those billion people into our heads. You just call it the net and think of it like that, all right? But as we're out there using the net, we're affecting it, it's affecting us. And it's starting to sort of, it was very slow in the beginning, and it was almost impossible to see, say, 10 years ago, to see how it's sort of shifting. It's pivoting the axis of culture to make it face it. But now that pivot's becoming much more and more obvious. And we have a name for this phenomenon, the $2 word for the day, which is emergence. And emergence is a fancy way of saying that we have to treat the system, us and the net, as a whole. We can't separate it easily into parts. Because the net's more than the sum of its parts. And no matter how hard we try to see what the future is, it's really impossible to do it because things are growing. It's like looking at a child and trying to predict what that child is going to be like as an adult because there's an interaction between that child and its parents and its friends and its environment and its education. Well, that's exactly what's going on here. Everything is emerging into something new. So we can't know what the future is. I couldn't tell you what it was going to be like once the first mobile phone found YouTube. Now we know. We know something of what it's like. We don't know everything of what it's like, but we know something of what it's like now. We couldn't tell you what happened when politics found the collective intelligence of the net. Now we have some idea. So because we can't know what the future is like, what we can at least do is we can take a look at the past, which we've done, and start to focus on the present. Here's what we can see. The net has shrugged off all of the attempts to confine it to the safe world of commerce where it can be managed. All right? That doesn't mean that people don't make an awful lot of money off the net. They do. They will continue to. It's a good place to make money. All right? But for 5 years, that was what the game was. We now know definitively that is no longer true. All right? And yes, other fortunes will be made on the net. But it's a sideshow. All right? And you need to keep that in mind. Whenever you look at the net and someone's going, oh my God, this company's so big, it's so huge, and it's trillions of dollars. Yeah, fine, it's a sideshow. It's a bearded lady. Don't worry about it. All right? That's point one. Money's a sideshow. Don't even worry about it. Point two, sharing is a more profound activity than we had ever realized. We were all taught when we were young to share our toys and to share our drinks and all of this because it's polite and it's civilized and it's a good thing to do. But now that we are actually able to share across the net on this absolutely massive scale, what we understand is that the idea of sharing extends well beyond the virtues of the niceties of polite behavior. All right? That sharing itself has an inherent value. All right? That the more something is shared, the more valuable it becomes. Wikipedia is the textbook definition of why this is. There are a lot of other examples, but Wikipedia is the absolute textbook definition of why this is. All right? And that sharing itself, which is something that was hard to do before the era of the net. All right? Not impossible, it's damn difficult. Sharing is a powerfully seductive force that sort of has a gravitational energy of its own. All right? That when things get shared enough, or certain communities decide they're going to share certain things, they actually get strength out of that. That in fact, Talking Points Memo could take on the U.S. government because they were able to share information and willing to share information in particular ways. And the third thing I want to point out is that the sweetness and light of this new world that we were creating on the net back in 1994 was totally wrong. All right? Even though we have the sweetness and light of all this sharing, this explosion in knowledge, and this transparency that's coming along, all right, what we really have and what we're giving to you is something very different. All right? We are giving you a raw, brutal war where you're going to have these monolithic powers, their governments, their corporations, blocks of the electorate, whatever they might be, all right? And they're going to be waging war with everything they've got against these ephemeral assemblages of collective intelligence. That's what the 21st century looks like. And we can say that now because we're into the 21st century a little bit. And that's not what the 20th century looked like. All right? We can see it now because in the battlefield, they're practicing something called asymmetric warfare. There's a great blog that I read called Global Guerrillas, which talks about how all of these techniques that I've been describing to you aren't just being used by the good guys. They're being used by the bad guys. You think Al-Qaeda can't use these same techniques to organize themselves to collective intelligence? Of course they can, and they do. All right. So this battle isn't simply between governments as monoliths and people power. It's also between terrorist organizations and governments and terrorist organizations and people power, and it goes on. And the network is amplifying all of that. Sharing is amplifying all of that. And so what we've got now with all of the gifts of the net are a set of problems and a set of possibilities beyond anything we could even conceive of in that conference room in Geneva in 1994. We're empowered as never before, and for that reason, we're threatened as never before. And that's a paradox. Thank you. All right.